This is the official EFL podcast.
Hello again, and on this week's Legends of the EFL show, we're speaking to a man whose story on and off the pitch is one of the most inspiring in sport.
And now it's Thompson! Well, he's won his own real survival fight. Football is nothing compared to that. But that is a hugely important goal, which may just keep Rochdale in League One.
Wow, what a substitution by Keith Hill. What an impact Joe Thompson has just had, not only on this game, but on Rochdale's season, on Rochdale Football Club, and where they may be playing their football next season. Look what it means to Keith Hill.
It's some story. It's his first goal since February 2017. A man who has twice beaten cancer, that's the real survival battle.
We're with Joe Thompson. First of all, Joe, you just listened to that goal back. How does it feel now seeing it again, that goal against Charlton?
It brings a smile to my face, yeah. And, you know, I can see all the emotion. Like I said, I've only really watched it once, and it was, I think it was the day after where I actually watched it on TV, and I fast-forwarded to 65th minute because not much had gone on prior. But, yeah, amazing. And I tend to not so much look at myself when I see it. I pick up on all the different aspects, and, you know, you can see all the faces and the fans and what it means to the fans. Because I've said it before, they knew the story inside and out. They've been with me through it all and supported me through it all. So, yeah, the emotion. And I remember jogging back to the halfway line and looking up, and I could see my family and my little girl buzzing and whatnot. But there was grown men crying. There was women that were like flabbergasted and couldn't believe it. So for me to live out that moment, yeah, it was. It was magical.
Yeah, it shows you how much football means. We'll come back to that in more detail later on. But I want to go back to the very start of your football career now.
Yeah.
Youth career at Man United. What was that experience like for you at such a prestigious football club?
Yeah, it's such a great time as well. When I look back, spoilt rotten. But it was the best education going. You know, the first team were doing amazing things, you know, and they went on to make history with the treble and whatnot. And with Sir Alex Ferguson at the helm, the standards were right up there. And I think for me, looking back now, I realised the bar was set, not just as a footballer, but as a person. And that's the one thing I can always say and thank Man United for. You know, they took me around the world. I travelled where I'd never been to certain places. They taught me so much on the football pitch as a young lad. And it was the foundations that meant I was able to go on and have a good football career. But they did. They also taught me so much about being a good man and a good person.
Yeah, sport in general as well was something you thrived at, wasn't it? Just tell us about the athletics career as well.
I was always very athletic, and I think that was obviously why I was able to then transfer that into football and end up playing on the wing. You know, a lot of endurance, very quick, and I was always very good at athletics, whether it was 100, 200. I usually tended to do 800 metres. And I think at one point I was probably, I think I was third fastest in the country when I was about 14. But it did, it got to a point where I had to decide whether I wanted to go down the football route or down the athletics route. And as a young boy there, although I love watching the Olympics and stuff like that, for me, I always wanted to be part of a team. So I always felt quite nervous when it came to athletics, even though I did generally win. I felt quite alone, and I felt like the pressure was on all the time, especially as you get a better reputation and whatnot. So for me to be a part of a team was where I really felt that's what sent me down the football route.
And of course, you can't obviously ignore the lure of somewhere like Manchester United,
no,
especially at that time.
No, you can't. And I know my mum was torn when they offered me a contract when I was a young boy, because the likelihood of me making it there was going to be slim. And she knew that it was going to break my heart at some point. But like you say, when Manchester United come knocking, it was kind of a Willy Wonka moment, the golden ticket. And yeah, I absolutely loved it. I would wear that training kit and tracksuit as much as possible because I was proud and there was no way of getting away from that. And a lot of the lads that were in and around my age group have all gone on to play professional football at various levels.
How important, though, was sport for you after what wasn't, of course, the easiest childhood, moving from Bath to Rochdale to live with your auntie? Can you just tell us about what sport gave you?
It gave me the structure. You know, I'm forever grateful, particularly to my mum and my brother for being there through thick and thin. And my auntie as well. Like you said, she brought us up to Rochdale to kind of stop me from going into to care, me and my brother, because my mum had been put on a psychiatric ward down in Bath because she was suffering from a mental illness. But she's a magical woman to be around. And I always say when she's on top form, the world and the room in a way is hers. And so for me to move up to Rochdale was different. It was a big culture change. I was always brought up in a very multicultural environment down in Bath. And I never saw colour as such. And, you know, being dual heritage, mixed race, whatever you want to say, it was just the norm for me. But I soon got a shock when I arrived in Rochdale. Probably first encountered racism. But, yeah, I think for me, sport, football, having someone to listen to as a coach as well and try and do as I'm told, not all the time, was massive for me. And to have that structure and, you know, like I say, that discipline aspect was really good, because life was never, I would say, easy as such at home.
You mentioned coaches there. One of the most influential ever, of course, Sir Alex Ferguson in charge.
Yeah.
At the time, you've got an interesting story with Sir Alex where you tapped him on the shoulder. Can you just... and then ran away, I believe.
Yes.
Just tell us a bit about that. Explain it.
Getting brought up, this one.
It sounds like you were very brave.
I was Jack the Lad, and I always have been. And the change room that I was in had kids all around Manchester, and we were all the same. You know, a lot of us had pretty much been brought up with nothing, but we was very good at football, and we would always enjoy ourselves. But, yeah, we was away in Ireland on a trip, basically representing the club. And Sir Alex Ferguson came over for a day or two, and he was talking to all the kids. And obviously, we'd come across him a few times, but I decided I was going to do the old trick and tap him on the shoulder and then ran around the other side. And at the time, he didn't really clock it. But then when I got back to Carrington about a week or two later, I was walking down the corridor, minding my own business. And he just said, "Hey, next time you do that, you're going to get it." And I was like, I knew exactly what he was talking about. And he said, "Now get out on the training pitch." I was like, no problem, Sir Alex.
I mean, how influential was it, though, having someone like that, you know, not at the forefront of your career, but in your career at that time, knowing you were working with someone like that?
No, listen, I was like every kid. I had the posters of the team, you know, David Beckham, Ryan Giggs, Paul Scholes, the Neville brothers, but it's the class of 92, and you do, whether it's naively or not, dream to be like them. And when you're in that environment, it breeds success. It breeds an appetite to win, and I was no different. So to have, he's probably, I would say, the best manager ever. You know, there's an argument with Pep Guardiola, but we'll see in due time. But Sir Alex Ferguson was massive for not just English football, for world football in general. And I think at the time, commercially, it took Man United to another level as well. And you see, and I watch and I study now from a business point of view, a lot of the time with clubs and sponsorships and media deals and whatnot, it was just amazing. You know, I could go and knock on the kit man's door and say, "I need a new pair of trainers," or "I need a new pair of Nike football boots." and you get given them. Because, like I say, the standards have always been high. And I think that's probably what Man United is struggling with at the moment. The fact that the standards have been so high for so long. And once Sir Alex left, it was never going to quite be the same. And I know every manager that's gone in since has really struggled to really make sure they're playing as well as they can and as attractive as they can on the pitch. And also keeping the standards up for the fans.
It's hard,
the
hard to match the best, I suppose.
It is. It is. And, you know, everyone wants to try and kind of recreate in a way, but it is. It's tough. It really is.
And for you, when you were eventually, you know, you're taken away from that, released by the club, you know, not long before your 16th birthday as well, that must have been very, very hard to take at that stage of your life as well.
Yeah, I was, I'm going to say becoming a young man. There was a lot of hormones at the time. I was having to make sure I was studying for my GCSEs. And they broke it to me the best way they could, with everything. There's an element of class that they do. And I remember sitting down with Tony Whelan and Paul McGuinness at the time. And, you know, they were just saying, I'm not able to physically impact in games anymore because I was just very slight. I was still quite small. And at that age, some lads jump up and I've got beards and chest hairs and some lads stay behind. And that was where I was at in my physical development. So it was tough to take because I couldn't physically do anything about it. But yeah, it was, it's part and parcel of life and it was a setback at the time and it's how you get back up and go again in a way.
How did you deal with it yourself at the time? Like I mentioned there, you were 15 years old.
Yeah, no, I struggled. I didn't tell anyone for a while. So my friends would still knock on the door and it'd be Tuesday night and they'd still do it and they'd say, you coming out? Like, you coming for a kickabout? And I'd be like, no, I've got training. Even though I know I didn't have training. I know my mum would sit and try and talk to me through things. But it did. It really did dent my confidence. So like I say, I kept it to myself and then I started to open up to a few close friends and say, look, I'm not there anymore. And that in itself, once it got out, especially at school, you know, I felt like a lot of kids were there to point the finger and kind of laugh in a way. Say, like, for the 5-6 years I've been at school, see, you're not going to make it. And you're not going to be the star that you thought you were. But I did well in my GCSEs, so I was thankful that I did that. So I had a plan B.
I suppose, in a way, it's sort of a proverbial kick up the bum, isn't it? When you get some news at that age like
definitely.
That.
Definitely. I think it's the making of me, how I dealt with it then. I know certain things that have gone on since. I've always thought, you know what? It's not the end of the world. What can you do about it? You can only control the controllables. So how are you going to react? I've always done that.
And you said that you did well in your GCSEs.
Yeah.
Did you think you'd get another opportunity in football at the time?
Yeah, definitely. I was struggling with the fact that I had loads of options to go and play elsewhere, but I was accustomed to a certain environment. And it was the best. So I struggled even when I went down and played a local game for Wigan and Rochdale. I play on the wing. So I always, you know, half time or at the start of a game, I looked down the line and I could see this line was wiggling and it was all over the place. I was thinking, what the hell has this groundsman been doing? Has he had a few drinks? But it was tough to take and even like the surface of certain playing fields, I was like, really? How am I supposed to dribble on this? But, you know, you call it arrogant, chip on the shoulder, whatever. I had to lose that and I had to lose it quick because I was where I was. And if I wanted to play professional football, I was going to have to knuckle down.
Of course, you eventually ended up at Rochdale. You know, tell us about how that move came about initially.
So initially, like I say, I'd been and done the rounds in the Northwest and clubs wanted to take me. I know Blackburn were interested. Like I say, Wigan really wanted to take me as well. But I was just struggling and I think I needed to probably find the enjoyment in football again. So my PE teacher, Mr. Ayres, just basically said to me, why don't you go down to Rochdale? And I was like, are you kidding me? He was like, no, I can see you struggling and you're not enjoying it anymore. So why don't you go and be a big fish in a small pond and see how you get on? And I did that. And that was probably the first time I met Keith Hill. I know I mentioned it in my book. The first time I met him, I'd always worn earrings. So I had these little diamond earrings in that I forgot to take him out for training. And the first line he came out was, well, take your effing grandma's earrings out. I was like, oh, never been spoken to before like this. But that was the harsh reality of it. And I was embarking on a journey in a way into men's football. So, yeah, that was another kick up the backside. And, you know, our relationship from then on only went on from strength to strength.
And then, of course, you made your debut as a 17-year-old against Carlisle, I believe.
Yeah.
What was that like, as you mentioned there, against men as an introduction to the EFL at the time?
Yeah, so when I signed for Rochdale, they wanted to fast-track me into the first team. And I was playing under Steve Parkin, and he gave me my debut against Carlisle. And I played against a player called Igor Arinaldi. And he played hundreds of games. A wily old left back, but with bags of experience, and it was against a really good Carlisle team. I remember we got beat 2-0 on the night, and we were getting beat 2-0 when I came on. And I just thought to myself, I'm quicker than him. I'm just going to take him on. But when I say this guy knew all the tricks, knew all the flicks, seen it all before, got the T-shirt. And yeah, he didn't give me a minute's peace. But I remember just thinking, wow, this is physical, this is fast. And, you know, the 20 minutes or so that I played soon flew by. But it was something that I could tick off and say, you know what, I played professional football and I made my debut at 17. So, yeah, onwards and upwards.
He certainly sounds like a character that you'll never forget. You'll never forget that name, will you?
No, not at all. And he was Spanish and he had long grey hair. So I was like, definitely, you know, young pup just going to think I'm going to take on this old dog. But it wasn't the case.
Then in 2008, your career really did take off under Keith Hill, of course. You've touched on it there, but what was it like learning under him? You know, it's, from reading into it and seeing, you know, interviews, it sounds like there's a real great respect between you both, isn't there?
Yeah, like I say, I think for me, it's black and white with Keith. A lot of the time he's testing you and he's probing you. He wants to get a reaction. But I listened to an interview not long ago about Sir Alex Ferguson saying about character and the fact that he knew he had talented footballers, but he was not so much more concerned about making sure the character was right, but it affects the changing rooms and the dynamics of groups. And we've talked about the dynamics of groups in Love Island. But, yeah, it was good. I often remember thinking, coming in and leaving training, have I done something wrong to him today? Was I that bad? And then when I take stock, I think, no. And I take myself back in the next day and he'd be there. He's a tough taskmaster, but, you know, he wants to get the best out of you. And if he can teach you certain things along the way, especially early doors, it's only till you get older then you realise, I've heard this before. And then I think, where have I heard it? And I'll be like, Keith Hill. So, yeah, he's always trying to encourage you and trying to make you a better player, but also a better person.
I should say we were talking about Love Island before the interview actually began.
Hot topic.
Unfortunately for some people.
Yeah.
We do apologise.
Yeah, sorry. We have our flaws.
But coming back to Keith Hill, again, I've touched on it there, but more than a manager for you?
Yeah, I class him as a friend now, especially as I'm older. And the weird thing is, we don't actually talk that much, but when we talk or we see each other, it's exactly the same. And I think that's quite a clear indicator with all your good friends, even if you haven't seen them for a while. You don't ask, oh, how such and such. You just fall back into your roles in a way.
I think I've read that he said that you're like a family member to him.
Definitely, and it's one of them, it's I still call him Gaffer. I think that's the measure of it. I've had different managers, but I still call him Gaffer. And yeah, that's where we're at with that one.
Can you just tell us, if you can, you know, over the years, what your best story about Keith? That's clean enough to tell on this podcast, of course. It's a family podcast.
Yeah, the best story about Keith. No, you know, the one of the stories that I probably can share was everyone thinks he's tough, he's hard. But, you know, when it came to the last day of the season and that goal, when the Oldham game was playing against Northampton and there were 7 minutes, you know, of extended time, and we were waiting to see what their result was, Keith took himself into the office and lay on his couch that he's got in there and turned off all the lights, because he's a teddy bear at times, and he is. He's got a heart in there, and I think, you know, he understood the emotion of it and probably needed to take himself out of the environment because it had been a roller coaster season. And I remember also the time we got promoted the first time around with Rochdale. He came in crying because we finished third. But I remember the lads saying to him, like, we've given it our all. We had a young squad that were overachieving every week, and we probably just run out of steam. So, yeah, we maybe should have gone up top or second, but to finish third and get promoted for the first time in a long time with Rochdale was a magnificent achievement. So, you know, in heart of hearts, there's a, although there's this tough exterior and, you know, he's a man's man and it's black and white, there's a heart in there.
It shows you how much it means to him as well.
Oh, I say to him, like, you'll do well to find a man that's more passionate about football. He lives and breathes it. And if on a Monday morning you've not watched the Saturday 12 o'clock game, the 3 o'clock game, you've not watched Match of the Day, and you've not seen that clip, and did you see that? He'll make sure you watch it. So, yeah, he does. He loves football, and I'm sure he'll be back in football when he's ready.
You then moved away from Rochdale, coming back to your career, to Tranmere. In what you described as getting out of your comfort zone at the time, was that move right for you at the time now, looking back?
Right move, wrong time. Top and bottom of it, I had a little girl that was on the way. So Lula was, well, she was born 4 weeks after I'd been at Tranmere. And I was, I'd say, a young dad. I was only 22. So, like I say, comfort zone. Keith had moved on. The club had moved on. I'd had options the season prior to go to the Championship. But I struggled with injuries. So I was at a point in my life where I felt like I was at a crossroads. And, you know, it was time to move on. I played 150 games or so, scored goals, been promoted, and I just felt like it was time to move on. And when the bid got accepted off Tranmere, I felt that I was half out the door in a way. And I spoke to John Coleman and Jimmy Bell, who were managing at the time, and said, I think I'm going to move on. And they said, well, thanks for the honesty, and, you know, we wish you well. And that's what football does. But like I say, I was... wrong time. I didn't know I was suffering from cancer at the time. And, yeah, it was just... I put all the tiredness and certain symptoms that surround cancer with just being a new dad and new environment, changing and having to travel a little bit further as well. So, no regrets. Massive club as well. Really happy to see Tranmere back where they belong, because the fans on the Wirral, absolutely, they love their football. So, yeah, good on them.
Like you said, sort of at the time, it seemed like a natural sort of progression, I suppose.
Definitely.
But, you know, you look at it now in hindsight, you know, 23 years old at the time, you know, coming into the peak of your career, but you had that first cancer diagnosis, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
When did you... realise, you sort of touched on it there, but when did you realise that there was a problem?
after the first season. So I played quite a few games for him in the first year, but I didn't do myself justice in a way. Like I say, they paid quite a substantial amount of money for me. I was on a good wage, and I wasn't doing myself justice, and I wanted to justify it to the manager, Ronnie Moore, and also the fans. So the season finished and it kind of petered out. I found myself on the bench quite a lot. And I remember going into the off-season thinking, I'm only going to take a week away. I'll nip to Portugal, but while I'm out there, I'm going to hit the ground running. I'm going to stay on top of everything. I'm going to be in the gym. And I remember starting back at pre-season and flying. I was not streaks ahead of people, but I was right up there. And I was in top condition in a way. But at the time, I obviously didn't know that inside and internally in a way, I was fighting a horrible disease. So it came to a point where I started the season, I was scoring goals, man of the matches. I was like, see, yeah, here we go. Time to kick on and, you know, hopefully get to the championship and maybe the premiership where everyone dreams to play. But it just came to a head. I just got ill one night. I had night sweats, which is a massive telltale sign regarding cancer. And when I say night sweats, it's not like a fever. It's like the bed is drenched and you actually take the sheets off, the pillows off, and it was not a nice experience at all. And I probably had two or three of those. Then I flagged it up with a doctor that I wasn't feeling so great. Still training, still playing, but slowly but surely I felt like something was creeping up on me. I remember waking up in the middle of one night and just feeling like a snake was wrapped around my neck and slowly but surely suffocating me. And it was not a panic attack, because cancer can make you short of breath depending on where it is. And I went to the club doctor the next day. I was sick in the car on the way to training. And I just said, I've got this sharp pain in my neck. Some lumps have popped up. I'm struggling to get my arm up above my head when I go for headers or get it out, you know, when I want to push somebody away from me. And I just think I've got something wrong. So we said, right, well, we'll send you off for a biopsy. And after 4 or 5 days, I went back on to the Wirral and sat with a professor in the hospital. And that's when he diagnosed me with Hodgkin's lymphoma.
At that age, though, you're a footballer in peak physical condition. Yeah. You wouldn't think, you know, a prime candidate for such a horrible condition. It must have been a massive shock, despite, you know, what you say now in hindsight are telltale signs.
Yeah, I didn't have a clue about cancer. Knew nothing about the symptoms. None of my family members had suffered at the hands of it. And, yeah, I just remember saying, check again. And he's like, no, like, do you want the good news or the bad news? I said, well, you've given me the bad news. What's the good news? He said, well, it's stage 4S, but that's quite far gone. And you've probably been suffering for 2 to 3 years with it. And it's treatable, though. But we need to get going with the treatment as soon as possible. So my world just stood still. Naively for me, I took my little girl, who was one now, my partner, my wife, Chantel, with me to the hospital. And, yeah, it's probably the worst day of my life, that one, because I've just been told the worst news of my life. I have no knowledge or information regarding it. And anything that I did know about it tended to lead to death. So it was like, this is it, it's over. And I'm meant to be the rock and the strong one you know a little bit about my life. I've always prided myself on being a family man and looking after everyone. And I've got a little girl here that I don't know whether I'm going to make it to a second birthday. And, you know, I'm trying to be strong for my partner. And she knows I'm crumbling inside.
I mean, I imagine it's still difficult to talk about now.
Yeah, you know, it's quite emotional and draining. Plenty of tears, and I don't mind saying that. You know, big boys do cry, and I'm no different. But, yeah, it's it's all a bit surreal in a way. It's a bit like you just enter into like a hurricane and you don't know when it's going to stop. And what he said from after that, I was a bit of a blur, really, if I'm being honest. I just remember thinking, how am I going to tell my mum? How am I going to tell my brother? Then got to tell my agent. And he's then got to tell the club. And then the club have got to tell kind of the footballing world. So, yeah, it's all quite overwhelming.
And obviously, it's not as significant as your life, but you were told at the time your football career was more or less
done.
Yeah,
that is what I said. So, okay, so 6 months worth of chemotherapy. I said, this is October 23rd. I said, I'll be back playing then, won't I? April, I'll get the back end of the season. And then that's where he just looked at me like, you don't understand, young man. Like, it's not only your football career might be over, your life might be over if you don't do something ASAP. The football just became irrelevant. You know, I can't play football if I'm not here. Can't play football if I'm not healthy as such. So, yeah. But I remember thinking, still could be worse. Like, I could have nothing. I could have no family to support me. Nobody to take me to and from hospital when this treatment does start. I could have no money. I could have no hope in a way. Or nobody to talk to, so... I just remember thinking, just try and find a positive, even though you are in a bit of a sticky situation.
It must have been, in a way, though, when you did make that recovery, it must have been no better motivation for you to get back into football, I suppose.
It's everything I know. Yeah, it was everything I know. The good thing for me is I was a professional footballer, so I was strong, I was fit, I was healthy to a certain extent to withstand what was coming regarding the chemotherapy. And you know, chemotherapy affects everyone in different ways, and it's horrible, but it does save a lot of lives. So if you've got to go through hell to get to heaven in a way, then so be it. And when I did get put into remission after 6 months of chemotherapy, it was a sense of relief that I was able to just get my life back on track and hopefully get my football career back on track.
How grateful were you to Berry at the time for giving you a chance after your recovery, a chance which Tranmere really didn't give you?
No. I thought with the Tranmere situation, my two-year contract had come to an end. And, you know, I got the letter through the poster saying kind of, thanks for your services in a way. So that was quite a shock. That was, I suppose, the ruthless and the business side of football. For probably 8 or 9 months of that second season, I'd been no good to them in a way. The fans were amazing. I did a campaign called Grow for Joe, and we raised about 40,000 or 50,000 pounds while I was at home, you know, trying to get back to messages, sending out wristbands and all donating. So that was really tough, because when I kept on asking, when am I coming back, I was desperate to just say it how it was, but I thought, no, you're going to have a little bit of class and a bit of dignity in a way. And I think I put a tweet out saying something like, I can't sign a line that's not there. But like you say, I was so grateful for Berry, and in particular Dave Flitcroft, for taking a chance, because that's what it was. I couldn't promise you anything. If you looked at me, I looked okay, but I knew I was hollow in a way, and I'd had a lot of muscle wastage. There was a lot of leftover debris in a way that comes with chemotherapy, and my muscles and my body weren't quite feeling the same, but I was going to give it my best, and yeah, that's all I did.
Yeah, it's not the best sort of cancer to recover to be a professional footballer.
No, especially with it being of your immune system. So obviously when you're playing football, you're constantly tearing muscle fibres. So for me to have my immune system compromised, and then chemotherapy affects everybody's immune system, It was like a double whammy. And then I was going to go and play and throw myself right back into football. And I remember the hospital and the doctors were really anxious and they didn't want me to get back into as fast as I could. But I had nothing else. Like I say, my wife wasn't able to be out there working because she was either looking after my little girl Lula or looking after me in between appointments. So, you know, you put a little pot aside, a few savings. We got rid of any of the nice cars. We stripped everything back. And yeah, it was, I just thought to myself, I have to do it for my family. I have to get back into football. And even if I give myself a year and start looking at other things along the way, as long as I give it my all, then that's all I can do.
How did your perception of football change, though, after you got through that first cancer battle?
The beauty of football, it is, it's a beautiful game, but there's some things that a lot of people don't see. So for me, the fans epitomised it. The support they gave me, and they literally did rally round and get one of the soldiers out the trenches in a way. And I'm forever grateful for that. I can never, ever repay them. I do my best to. Anytime I come across any football fan, I'll try and give them the time of day and have a little chat about their team and whatnot. But, yeah, football moves on. And nobody's forgotten about the situation, but it took a brave manager to take a punt on me and say, you know what, I'll give him a chance and we'll see what he's like. So, yeah, I just thought to myself, football can finish like that, whether it's illness, an injury. You know, you could get released and be shocked. Your club could go into administration and you're left without a contract in a way. It could be anything, but it just, I remember thinking, every day you play, just be grateful for it and try and enjoy it. And I never really saw it as a job until I got a little bit older, because it just transpired that I'd played it as a kid, been good at it, and now I'm starting to get paid to do it, and I'm still loving it. I love the changing rooms. I love being on the training pitch. I love being in the gym with the lads, and I love playing on a Saturday and a Tuesday, because I'm an ultimate competitor. Whether it's a game of cards, whether it's, you know, a board game, I will do anything and everything to win.
I mean, it didn't work out for you in the end, did it, at Bury?
No.
But you then earned yourself a contract under Keith Curl at Carlisle. What was that experience like for you working under him?
It was wicked, you know. I really enjoyed it. I'd never met the man. But it reminded me of when I spoke to Keith Hill the first time. He rang me up after I played five-a-side with my mates. And when I say my mates, when we play five-a-side in the summer, there's the likes of like Danny Simpson, Danny Drinkwater, Nicky Blackman, Mike. It's a good five-a-side team.
Yeah, quite high standards.
Yeah. So I just decided we'll play a little bit, a five-a-side near the Trafford Centre. And the phone rang when I just got in and I was just about to get in the bath. I was feeling so stiff. And I said, who's this? He's like, it's Curly. I was like, right, okay. Curly who? He was like, Keith Curl. I was like, all right. So obviously I knew about him, how many games he played and how good of a player he was. But I never really, apart from when I played against him at Mansfield, come across him. So he's like, what are you doing? I was like, oh, I'm just sat watching the TV. He was like, well, do you want to come and earn a contract? I was like, what do you mean? He was like, get yourself up to Carlisle tomorrow. So I was like, ran over to Shantel. I was like, Shan, check how far Carlisle is on the phone.
Quite far.
Yeah, quite far. He was like, get up tomorrow. I was like, can I not come up on Thursday? He was like, are you winding me up? I'm offering you a contract. Come up, earn it, and we'll speak to you tomorrow. I'll see you at 10 o'clock. I was like, right, get this bath going. It's time for an early night. And I did. I just got in the car at about 6 o'clock the next morning, took the drive up to Carlisle. And then when I got out the car, I literally folded myself out the car, and he happened to pull up. alongside me in the car park, and I jumped out, and he literally looked like me, but probably, I'm going to say 20 years older.
And he said, Keith wouldn't be happy with 30 years older.
No, he was like, "You're right, fella." And he looked at me like, "I see your shoes, I see your shorts, I like your shirt." But instantly from then I thought, I think I'm going to get on with him. And yeah, we did.
And towards you know the end of your career, I want to touch on this now, with the fact that you know your contract, you had to really earn them, didn't it? You towards the end of your career. It's not...
No contract's ever a given.
Exactly.
I know what you're trying to say. Like it was...
It's hard though, isn't it? At that level of football, you know, the EFL, quite lucrative, but at the same time, you've got a family to provide for. To be given the... You know, you were never given that assurance, were you, towards the end of the career? You never offered, like, a 4 or 5 year contract.
The thing is, for me, I don't mind pressure. I often thrive with pressure. And that's also probably my downfall, in a way, because I've needed to be pressure situations so to get the best out of me. I've maybe found myself in a comfort zone. But, yeah, like you say, contracts I've got shorter over the years. Clubs' budgets have got smaller, so the numbers in squads have got smaller, and it's ruthless, it's cutthroat. And you know, fans and people outside of the football world sometimes think you're earning millions. Top boys are, but you still don't know what they're spending, you still don't know what their outgoings are. So it is a job, and you know, like you say, you've got bills to pay and responsibilities. And I often say when I sit down with a younger pro now and try and mentor him, let's make sure you're putting your money in the right places and you're investing for the future, because, you know, touch wood, if everything goes well, brilliant, but there is often, you know, a hiccup or a setback along the way. So if you're prepared for it, then the setback won't be nowhere near as big, because I know money's not the be-all and end-all, but if you've got your finances in order, it takes a lot of pressure off. Not just you, it takes a lot of pressure off your family as well. So, yeah, it's been an emotional roller coaster. But, yeah, like I say, I think it was, I read a stat the other day, 600 players get released and they're out of contract. So you're in the rat race. You're one of so many. Don't ever think you're the only one that's being released. But, yeah, you've got to go and earn them contracts. And yeah, I would like to say I've done. I've just took it a little bit close to the wire at times.
You eventually, like you said, earned a contract. You got a contract back at Rochdale then. What was that like for you, you know, coming home after, you know, a few years away from the club?
I was in a bit of a different space now. I left Carlisle on very good terms. You know, I'd played more games than I played at Bury. Everything started to feel easy again and finding a rhythm under Keith Curl. And I sat down with him and I said, "What's the script?" And he said, "Well, I can offer you another deal if you want, but I can't offer you a starting place. And I think that's where you're at now and that's what you want." And I was like, "Exactly." So kind of, thank you very much. Appreciate your honesty. I take myself back home. And then when I spent 2 or 3 weeks at home, I realised how much I'd missed being at home. So when Keith rang me and said, "Do you want to come in and train at Rochdale?" I was anxious. I was nervous, but I'd been given an opportunity to prove myself again. But like I say, I didn't want to taint anything that I'd done and tarnish the work that I'd done beforehand, because I didn't want to let the fans down.
Did you feel a responsibility to the Rochdale fans at that time, I suppose?
They supported me on the pitch and they supported me off the pitch. I didn't want to come back and feel like it was a token gesture or a burden. So I was still a little bit unsure of what I could physically do. But as soon as I got back training and playing under Keith, because his training is intense, you'll ask anybody that's trained under him, it's relentless. The foot is on the gas all the time, high octane, high press, especially from the front lads, and he wants the energy. But after a month or so, I was in the mix and I was feeling good. So when I earned the offered me a 6-month deal, I was like, right, So you've got 6 months to go and really kick on. And after a month or two, the club came and offered me another deal for 18 months. And like I say, I'd earned that one because I was playing well and the club was doing well in particular. So I was delighted to sign that. And I felt at home again in a way.
And of course, you changed so much as a person since you first left.
Yeah.
Didn't you? You were completely... Were you a completely different footballer as well when you came back, or were you the same?
No, like I say, I've always been very athletic. I'd learnt certain things off different managers, but you, at the end of the day, you've got to sometimes adapt your game to suit the team's way of playing and also what the manager wants. But I knew what Keith Hill wanted. He wanted me to be positive. He wanted me to put pressure on the fullback, or if I played up front. He wanted me to score goals. He wanted me to create goals. It's as simple as that. He didn't really coach me on the pitch as much because he knew I've got a good understanding of the game. I read the game well and I knew what he wanted from me. But what he would do is if he saw me take my foot off the gas, he'd be on it straight away. And he'd be barking orders saying, make sure you do this. Make sure you don't. Don't you be having an afternoon off, blah, blah, blah. So I was enjoying it again. But this time I was, when I went home, I didn't take things personally or I didn't overthink certain things because, you know, I had so much time to think and I'd also found myself as a person. And I was a lot stronger minded, a lot more determined. And I also just appreciated life a lot more than what I probably did as a kid.
And of course, like you say, you're doing so well. But then you were told that the cancer had returned.
Mm-hmm.
Sum up your emotions at that time when things are again going so well for you, and then you find out something that I believe you thought had gone at the time.
Yeah, you know, for any cancer survivor, 2-year mark is massive. This was my 3-year milestone in a way, and I just happened to go in for a scan. Because I put myself forward for a research and a trial. So this one was the last scan that I was going to have. Obviously, been in remission for nearly 3 years now. And I was just going to have to go in just before Christmas. And I'd had scans after and everything had been fine. But the doctor just said, I want you to come in and have another scan because we've just noticed something slightly different than your last scan. So I was like, right, okay. He said, there's nothing like untowards, or we just want to double check. I was like, right, okay. And then I remember I got called in on Christmas Eve and I was due to be in training at 10:30. And I said to Keith, you know, I've got another checkup. I'm just going to go back for my results and I'll see you at training. And I went in at 9:00 and I remember going in with my wife, who always came with me, and being told that it's back and the cancer had returned. It was the same cancer, it was Hodgkin's lymphoma, but there was one tumour, whereas the first time round there was a large watermelon-sized mass tumours on my chest and in other areas, but it was showing signs of being active and spreading. And I remember just looking at the doctor, who by this time I built up a relationship with, and just saying, you're kidding me, aren't you? He was like, no, I'm so sorry to tell you this, Joe. But I was just filled with rage and anger. I wanted to just smash the room to places because I felt like I'd done everything right. You know, I'm a good person. I didn't deserve this in a way. So, like, why me in a way? But I'm not a victim. I got to do what I got to do. And sad thing is, cancer's 1 in 2, 1 in 3 now. So I just remember thinking there, try and calm down. If anyone's going to have cancer, I'd rather it be me and take it on the chin in that way instead of anyone closer to me. So I got in the car and my wife could tell I was anxious and I was worried, but it was like we'd gone back in time. And I was going to have to make these phone calls again. And I remember Chris Beach, who was my assistant at the time at Rochdale, rang and it flashed up on the car. And then Keith rang and he said, "Where are you?" He said, "We're going to be starting soon." And I just parked up around the corner from training and I started crying. And he said, and then Chantel spoke to him and said, "Look, they've told him that the cancer's come back. He's obviously quite worked up and in tears, but I will bring him to training after training in a way when it's a bit quieter and he doesn't have to speak to all the lads." And yeah, did that. Some of them were there when I went into training, just finishing up with a few bits and bobs. And I remember speaking to a small group of them and just saying, "That told me it's come back, you know, and I'm going to need yous. I'm going to really need yous to, like, kind of get me through it, because it's going to be so much tougher than the first time round, because I'm going to have a lot more treatment." And, yeah, that's where we're at.
How important is the support, though, that you do get when you're going through those, the darkest possible times? How critical is that in your recovery?
It's massive. It's massive for me. It's also massive for my family to know that we have got an army behind us. And I talk about it in talks that I do now, and I do a lot of motivational speaking. Teamwork's imperative. Like, nobody that's successful ever does anything on their own. There's always a team underneath them or behind them, whatever you want to call it. And for me to be in this situation, I honestly don't know whether I would have got through it without the support of my team, Rochdale, but also football. And that's why I do my best to give back to football, because I don't think I can ever repay the debt in a way. But as long as I'm giving my all and giving back, then that's all I can do.
What was your main motivation, though, at the time to get through it? What was it that made you think, "I need to do this again"?
My little girl. And the sad thing was, is I didn't want her to be raised without a dad like me, for no fault of her own, if you get what I mean. So for me, it was the fact that I had a job to do, and that was my main job. Forget football. I often thought the one that was suffering most was my mum and my wife and my brother, because those three in particular would change with me in a heartbeat. Yeah, they could swap positions, they would have done it, no problem, no questions. So it was really tough to take, and I just remember thinking, still got to get this girl to prom. I still got to buy Lula her first car. I want to buy her a first house. I want to take her down the aisle. And 6 months prior to that second diagnosis, Chantel's father had been diagnosed with lung cancer. And we got married out in Ibiza. And it was like a minor military operation to get him out to Ibiza, because he was really struggling with his breathing. And then the strength that man showed me, to walk his daughter up the aisle, was what probably kept me going. And I remember thinking, when he handed her over to me at the end of the aisle, he just said to me, "It's over to you." And we knew what that meant as men. Like, he knew he was on borrowed time, and I think it was only 2 or 3 months after that he passed away. But I remember thinking, I got a job to do, and he just said to me, "Make sure you look after my angels." And I was like, right, no pressure, but I'm going to give it my all.
A lot of responsibility for you at the time.
Yeah, but, you know, the vow through sickness and health, that is never, the words have never been spoken truer. And that's it, through the good times and the bad. And I do, I've always prided myself on being a family man. And for me, like I say, I often give my little girl the attention in a way, and the love that maybe I maybe seeked as a kid, but found within football. That was what really kept me going. That was my main motivation. And the fact that I didn't want to be going anywhere. I had so much life to live myself and so many places and things that I wanted to achieve. I'd chalked off football the second time. I said, this is all this treatment that's coming. I was going to have to undergo a stem cell transplant. I don't think I'll get back to playing football.
So many, you know, extremes in your life, hasn't
there?
You know, some experiences that, you know, you'd hope that other people would never have to go through, but at the same time, so many happy experiences as well, I suppose.
Yeah, but I can always do something about it. You know, I think I don't watch the news, but I know there's places in this world that are having it a lot harder than what I was having it. So I often thought to myself, you know, as long as I can do something about it, I'm going to give my all. And the one line that I often think rings right is the fact that, you know, if cancer beat me, then so be it. You know, the fact that I'd never given up was massive, you know. And like I said, if it did get the better of me, then my family would have known that I'd literally given it my all and I'd just lost in a way.
What was it like, though, getting back to football? After going through all that and you were back on a football pitch?
Yeah.
Like you said, you couldn't have imagined it. You'd given up on it, but you were given the best support possible by your teammates and by Keith Hill, and you were back on the pitch. How did that feel, having that opportunity?
Incredible. So I had a year left, and I remember I underwent the stem cell transplant, and you know, I got put in isolation, and I spent 18 days in isolation. When I say 18 days felt like a lifetime, it really did. You have so many thoughts and emotions that you go through, so many dark days where you think, you know, I think it's time for me to throw the towel in, and then something will pick you back up. Spent my first wedding anniversary in there. I was in there Father's Day. I'd not seen my little girl for so long, and my wife just brought her in. We just defied what the doctor said. Any coughs or sniffles could have been fatal. You know, I was literally living off machines, but I just needed that little pick-me-up. And I remember day 17, when I was allowed to start having visitors, Brian Barry Murphy came in. And he basically opened the door and then shut the door. And then opened the door, then shut the door again. And I said, Murph, for God's sake, just come in, mate. He was like, Jesus, I have been pacing up and down the corridors, trying to, like, ready myself to come in and see you. And he said, you're looking great. I was like, Murph, I've lost 3 stone. I got no hair, no eyebrows. I appreciate the compliment, but stop lying. And then I think I left the day after. And I remember when the doctor said, you know, you can go home. I clutched for the bed. I was like, no, this is like my bunker, my safety blanket. I've got everything. Press this button. Emergency, you know, everyone will come in and help me. But I knew then that there'd be somebody else waiting to come and have this life-saving treatment. So get yourself out into the big bad world and go again. But it really hit me with the football thing. As soon as I hobbled out of the hospital and stepped off the curb, I tore my calf. And I was like, oh, I've pretty much been bedbound. And I've got so much work to do here. I think I'm going to be able to play football again. And it literally was, I'd walk with a physio sometimes. We'd just walk around the ground. And then I started to jog and then get on the bike. And then we'd just see how far I can go and then see if I could bring the time down. But the first day I went back into Rochdale, I asked the kit man, Jack, to throw some kit out for me and number it up. And he gave me the large, which I usually was, and it was so baggy. But I walked in to the gym, and they all started laughing. But we got the elephant out the room, and, you know, I felt like, yeah, this is where I belong. And, you know, thankfully for me, how the story then kind of transpired, I was able to give back because they just treat me like the same, you know.
Well, I suppose you were an inspiration to them, if you think
definitely,
about it.
I think they thought, Jesus, like, I can't believe how brave you are. Even the fact that, like, how I looked, I was totally aware that how I looked, you know. But I was sporting the uniform of somebody that's gone through treatment and got out the other end of cancer. So, yeah, I'd say I was an inspiration, but they kept me going. You know, just the fact that they was normal with me. They didn't, like, mollycoddle me or hold back with banter and stuff like that. Just kept me sane in a way.
And, of course, you eventually did get back playing. And another dream you fulfilled. Boyhood dream, playing at Wembley.
I know, I got asked about this the other day off some kids. It was amazing to play at Wembley. Stephen Davis has obviously scored in the FA Cup. That was on TV and everybody had seen it. And he got us a replay to play at Wembley against Tottenham. And I was sat on the bench, but the Beast from the East came. And it was one cold night, to say the least. And I remember we was 1-1 at half-time and we went into the changing rooms and the lads were buzzing. You could see they actually believed that we could go on and win this. But after about 10, 15 minutes of the second half, it was 4-1. I remember going to the toilet and coming out and looking up at the scoreboard and it was 4-1. I was thinking, Jesus Christ, what's going on here? They just took it up a level. And what Pochettino's done with his team now is no surprise. You see them making it to, like, the finals and doing so well. Because it's a young team, it's a quick team. I know that. And when Keith said to me at 4-1, just get out there and go and run around like a kid, because if anyone deserves it after, I think it was 7 months that I'd gone from being barely walking out of the hospital to making it and running out at Wembley, it's you. But I remember thinking after about 5 minutes, Jesus, these lot are quick. They were like the White Walkers. Especially in the snow, they were everywhere, and I enjoyed it. And I remember just thinking, you know what, the game's gone, but please try and savor the moments, because this wasn't guaranteed. And my family were all there; they were freezing. They'd gone kind of above and beyond to get down to the game.
I suppose they needed something to keep them going as well.
Definitely,
didn't they?
Yeah. And I remember thinking when I ran out, this is definitely going to be all over TV. Yeah, you know, everyone's going to be saying how remarkable it is that I've achieved this. And I tore my shoulder ligaments after about 10 minutes. Danny Rose smashed me in. And, you know, I just landed and happened to slide on what I'd call a very firm surface at Wembley. And I just thought, I cannot come off. So every time I passed or put my arm above my shoulder, I was writhing in agony. And then I came out after the game and all the media were waiting for me. And I had to take the sling off to show, like, nothing was wrong. But, yeah, it was a boyhood dream and something that I'll forever remember, definitely.
I know we've touched on it earlier, but then that game against Charlton came. That goal. Did you feel like there was something in the air that day?
I knew that was coming. I got the analyst guy, CJ, to, when I first got back to playing, to bring together like a compilation of all my goals and all like tricks and flicks and positive plays, especially in the final third, because I knew I wasn't going to train nowhere near as much as I'd like to. And I was, at this point, I was training probably once, maybe twice a week. There was some points where I remember we played Oxford the week before and I started the game, but Keith didn't want me to do the warm-up. He said, I'm going to give you 65, 70 minutes. Give me your all. Literally, burn out. And we'll see about going again on Tuesday. But then he left me out of the game against Plymouth. And I was like, wow. What's gone on here? And then it come down to the final day of the season, and I'd watched and visualised and looked over all like goals and little clips and just kept on watching it. And I remember dropping my little girl off to my mum's just before the game, and she played me the Greatest Showman song, This Is Me. And she was screaming and shouting it in the car, and she'd obviously been doing that at school and assembly. And I remember dropping her off and then listening to it on the way into the ground and thinking, this is me, this is my moment. Just wait. And yeah, after 65 minutes, Keith threw me on. And after 4 minutes of obviously my first two touches, it was in the back of the net. And I remember thinking, coincidentally at the time, it was against Ben Amos, who'd been in my Man United team as a kid. And I remember thinking, you've seen that one before, haven't you, Ben? But you still can't stop it. The place was pandemonium. It really was. Totally forgot it was on TV. I spoke to Don Goodman a couple of weeks ago when I did a talk for the PFA. And he remembers it clearly. He said, I've never been at a stadium where the emotion of a goal has been so, kind of high in a way. Because there could have been 55,000 people there. It really wouldn't have mattered. The roof literally got lifted. I've got friends that live in and around the ground, miles away, and they said it was like something had gone off. And like I say, you guys are covering it. It went everywhere. Worldwide trending. Kids are absolutely buzzing, like, oh my god, you were trending on Twitter. I was like, is this what society's come to nowadays?
a real Hollywood moment, though.
It was. And you know, if you said and you took it to the kind of film producer, they'd probably say, oh no, it's too much of a perfect ending. But it's in black and white, and I know it's, everyone remembers it.
And of course, you know, not a lot of people can say that about their careers, you know, ending in such a way.
No, I think I got given another year, but I tore my hamstring 3 times and it was a bad tear, like 7 centimetre tear, and I was having nerve pain down my left leg, and I just remember thinking, I don't know if you can push your luck, but just wait till you see the specialists in the hospital and let's see what they say. And I'd suffered from chronic fatigue, and it just means that, you know, I can train to a certain extent. Professional football, high intense every day, not really ideal, but you know, if it's say go to the gym 2-3 times a week and work out, yeah, perfect. But I couldn't, like I say, get any rhythm and train nowhere near as much as I'd like. So I just thought to myself, it really doesn't matter what I do now. The defining moment, in a way, is gone. And I had to accept that I was never going to get a feeling like I got that day. The relief, the elation, the emotion that I felt that day was incredible. So I knew even if I played on for another 5, 6, 7, 8 years and scored wherever, it just meant so much to me, and also so much to so many people, because like I say, it was a moment of hope, and it gave a lot of people a lot of belief and courage to obviously overcome their own setbacks in life.
And of course, you mentioned the fact that you were recognised. You know, you still are being recognised for it. And then after your retirement, you receive from the EFL the Sir Tom Finney Award. Just tell us how much that award, a prestigious award like that, one of the EFL's top honours, means to you.
Well, when Leanne, the media girl at Rochdale, told me, I said, you're joking me. And when she put the phone down and said, no, I'm not, it's going to be announced in the next week or two, I looked on Google and I saw the players that had won it before me, and I thought, I'm nowhere near in the calibre of these players. But when I took stock and looked at it, it was for my contribution to football on and off the pitch. You know, I'd done a book called Darkness and Light prior to Christmas, and that was so well received as well. And it was a different sort of autobiography from your general footballer story. And I remember thinking, I kept hearing this word, you're an inspiration, you know, you're such a role model. And I thought, I'd rather be known in a way as a great person than a great footballer. So I was overwhelmed that I'd obviously got the recognition and I was going to receive the award. But it never really dawned on me until the night when I saw DVT. And then I went up on stage and received the award off Colin Murray. And yeah, the whole room, standing ovation. Players that have played at the highest level, I've played hundreds of games. Teams that have gone on, you know, Sheffield United to get promoted to the Premiership. I remember looking around and thinking, there's so many people in this room that have done so much within football, and all of them are recognising and respecting what you've overcome in your life, Joe. So just try and compose yourself. Try not to cry. And yeah, a massive, proud moment. And it is, it's up on the mantelpiece, pride of place. And I won League Two Apprentice of the Award when I was 18 for my contributions and doing well on and off the pitch as a whitey for Rochdale. So it's full circle. And yeah, it was probably the highlight of my footballing career in regards to recognition. You know, scoring a hat-trick's nice. Scoring on your debut is brilliant. But I think, yeah, that was going to be the kind of mountaintop in a way. Pinnacle.
Yeah, I was in the room. It really did. I could see from your expression, it really did touch you receiving that award that night. It really got to you, didn't it?
It did, and I did my best to hold it together. And, you know, even when you thought everyone was going to sit down, they were still clapping. And it was like something out of a film. You know, when you've got the bright light on you and you're struggling to see and everyone's clapping. And I remember Colin just saying to me, enjoy it, mate, because you do deserve it. And I think you try and remain humble. But there was something inside of me that I did feel like I was like, just let go, Joe. Like, stop trying to be so cool. But I just remember thinking, cherish it, because you're never going to get this moment again. And yeah, like I say, it was just amazing. It really was.
How much does it inspire you now, though, that you have retired from football, that you inspire others so much with, you know, such an inspiring story that you've got?
I'm just being honest when I tell the story. Like, as long as I am being true to myself and trying to help others, I will do. And I'm looking to go in and inspire as many young footballers in particular, because the next generation are the ones, you know, that it really counts for. And if I can shed and share a little bit of knowledge with them of my life and my football career and help them in any way, shape or form, I will do my utmost.
But of course, it's not just footballers, though, is it?
No, it's not. It really isn't. And that's what, when, you know, certain talks start getting booked, I started to realise it doesn't matter whether in any workplace, any sport, there needs to be an element of resilience, and that's one thing I am. I'm stubborn, if you want to call it that. Never say die attitude. And, you know, I've probably won at the game of life in a way, and I'm forever grateful, and I truly appreciate that. But I also remember who helped me, so now it's my time to help others in whatever field. And like I say, I've done talks for big companies, for small companies. I've done talks in schools. I've done talks at football clubs. The message is the same. Just do not give up.
And I think we see on social media as well, you portray yourself to be, you know, you mentioned earlier about being Jack the Lad, but
yeah,
you're a very positive person. You've got a very positive outlook on all sides of your life.
That, yeah,
how important is that, though, in what you do? And
mindset is massive. It's something that I often study and, you know, read articles on. The power of the mind is huge. It's often the athlete. It can take you to so many places. As long as you believe And you have that self-awareness and you do have that positivity to keep going no matter what's coming your way and defy the odds. It is huge. And once you've done it and you appreciate it and you're grateful for it, you've got so much to smile about. Listen, we live in a world now where a lot of news and press is negative, but you've got so much to be grateful for. I remember the day I came home and I managed to get myself out of bed. And it's as simple as this. I literally put my feet on the carpet and I just thought, I've got carpet on my feet. I've got a roof over my head. What have I got to complain about? And I can affect the future now. My life's been on hold. So I think anyone that does come in and around me will say, you know what, he's a super positive guy. But I'm telling you now, I don't ever want you to go to the place where I've been to realise, go and do whatever you want with your life, but make sure you enjoy it, because there's days where I can be down and I'm not as upbeat as I'd like to be, but you've got so much to be grateful for. And yeah, that's the one thing I say is, don't live life to survive, live life to thrive. And I truly mean that.
It seems like you've got so much, in your own way, power to make changes. We're going to talk about now about the Christie charity and how much you are helping them. You know, something you hold so dear, of course.
Yeah.
How much does it please you to be able to support them now, especially with this upcoming match that you're going to hold, this charity game to support them? How much does it mean to you that you can give that something back to them? You have the power to do that.
Yeah, definitely. I think I feel like I have a platform now, and often, which is brilliant now, and what we're seeing a lot with social media is that footballers are using their platform and their social media to help others. Like, I've been watching Raheem Sterling over the last 12 months, 18 months, and it's been great what he's done on the pitch. You know, he's fulfilling his potential, but he's done so much off the pitch as well. And there's so many footballers like that. A lot don't kind of seek recognition or show what they're doing. But for me to be able to give back to the Christie, the place that has saved my life not once but twice, I can't really put it into a sentence. The fact that I am here to be able to do that is amazing. It's a miracle in a way. And I can't wait for the game. You know, all the fans keep messaging me, and I hope there is a good turnout, because the sad thing is cancer is 1 in 2, 1 in 3. So at some point in your life, you're going to be affected by it. And if I can look in 2 years' time and maybe, you know, with the help of the Christies and donations and people and support, I've built a hospital, for instance, that I know is helping people day in, day out and saving lives, is amazing. And if I can be an ambassador in any way, shape or form, then I'll do my best, because I know from the cleaners, from the nurses to the doctors, professors, the researchers, everyone's doing their best to try and find more cures and to save more lives. And the work that's been put in over the last 30 years, 40 years in a way, is incredible, but there's so much more that we've still got to do. So small gesture in a way to be able to give back, but nevertheless I'm sure they'll be appreciative of it. And I want everyone to come, you know, even Northwest, it doesn't matter what team you support. I'm going to do my best to make sure any of the lads that are still playing, they won't so much be able to play on the day, but they'll come down and support me and be in the stand, because again, if we can make memories for the kids, that's what it's all about.
You say you don't like the phrase retirement.
Nah.
As you said on your social media as well, I've seen.
You're finished.
But are you coming out with your retirement to play in this match? Your footballing retirement?
I'll be playing in that. No problem about that. I just need my hamstring to hold up. So I've played a couple of five-a-sides over the last few weeks. Body feels all right. So, yeah, I'll definitely be playing. How long I will play, I don't know, but I'll definitely, as always, give it my all, and I'll make sure I enjoy it. But I want to make sure everyone that's there enjoys it as well.
How does it feel to have, you know, so much support though already behind it, and hopefully a big crowd coming down?
Yeah, we'll see. It's like I say, if I can help somebody in the day or on that day, then that's job done for me. If I can help more than one, that's amazing. But like I say, there's going to be loads of stuff for the kids to do prior to the game, and for even for the older ones to see players that they've not seen for ages. I know a lot of the Rochdale fans are really excited to see some of the old players that have played. And the other team will have that element of celebrities. But Fabrice Muamba, you know, for me, for Fab to come down and support me, what I've done is, yeah, it's brilliant. But when I look at that man, that's an inspiration and an icon to me. And he has got all the time in the world for anybody. And he has that same positive outlook on life that I do. Because, you know, when you've been there and you've been struggling, you really do need to find the positives. And for him to say he's coming down, and the likes of Mark Wright, Frank Sinclair and others, it's incredible.
And people, of course, can actually even play themselves in the game, can't they?
There's a bidding war.
I understand that.
So for any fan who wants to play, it doesn't have to be Rochdale, they can bid to play. And if you do, you get your ticket online. I will personally be pulling out one lucky fan, in a way, to play. And I'm really looking forward to it. Because that's it there. In a nutshell, you've made a memory for somebody that can say they've played with their heroes, footballers, for an afternoon, for a good cause, and their donation is obviously going to an amazing place. So, yeah, I really look forward to it, and I do. I want to make sure everyone has a good time, but those fans that win, they've got an extra special day in a way.
Yeah, they've got their own story to tell forever, I suppose.
But that is it.
I mean, Joe, it's been incredible talking to you and listening to your story. And thank you very much for appearing on the podcast. And good luck in whatever you do in the future. I'm sure whatever it is, you'll be amazing at it.
No, thank you. My pleasure, Ben. Appreciate me.
The official EFL podcast. The best reaction to all the match action. Available every week.